Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
Okay, let's look at some of the real cardiac problems. What I did, some people like to look at a picture of the heart, and some people like to look at a representation of the heart. So I included both of those in the handout, but I'm going to discuss it from the point of view of the representation of the heart, the drawing. Okay, first of all, we're going to talk about what are called acyanotic defects. Acyanotic, the difference between the two is not a big deal. The only difference between an acyanotic defect and what we call a cyanotic defect is whether or not there is deoxygenated blood flowing in the systemic circulation. For example, with acyanotic defects, all that means is all the blood that flows to the systemic circulation is oxygenated. The amount of blood may not be correct, but every single drop of blood getting into the systemic circulation when you have an acyanotic defect has oxygen on it. When you have a cyanotic defect, not all the blood has oxygen mixed into it when it goes to the systemic circulation. It doesn't matter what goes to the lungs. That doesn't count in this definition. Only matters about systemic circulation, okay? Because we don't really care. If unoxygenated blood goes to the lungs, is that a problem? No, that's what goes to the lungs anyway, okay? But unoxygenated blood going to the systemic circulation, does that cause a problem? Sure, because what needs oxygen? Which organ demands the most oxygen? The brain, because the brain is the king. That's why it's on top of the head. We're going to look at some of the acyanotic defects. What that means is all the blood going to circulation does have oxygen. The problem is the wrong amount of blood is going, usually less than required. In the first two defects, we have something called an atrial septal, and then we also have the ventricular septal defect. If you look at the picture that I have up on the board, or you want to look in your handout, there is a picture of the four chambers of the heart with the septum down the center. And you can see that there's an opening between the chambers in the septum that doesn't really belong there. What happens is, as the blood comes in from the lungs to the left side of the heart with oxygen, right? Comes in with oxygen to the left side of the heart. And normally it goes from the left atrium to the left ventricle, out to the aorta, out to the systemic circulation, everything's fine. But in this case, you have an opening between the left and the right side of the heart. So blood comes into the left atrium, and with each pump, some of the blood will squeeze down to the left ventricle, but some of the oxygenated blood will shunt over, left to right shunt, over to the right side of the heart. The same thing happens in the ventricle. As the ventricle pumps, some of the blood will go into the aorta, but some of the blood will shunt over to the right ventricle. What you end up here is with a situation where the cardiac output from the left side of the heart is decreased. You're getting less volume going to the systemic circulation than what's required. So let's say the systemic circulation requires 50%. And the other 50% is on the right side. Well, now the systemic circulation is only getting about 25%. I'm just making up those numbers just to illustrate. Now the left side is only putting out 25% of the total volume instead of 50%. And the right side is getting 75% of the total volume instead of its 50 share. So what's going to happen? You're going to have a kid who has a decreased cardiac output. And when you have a decreased cardiac output, how does the body respond? Tachycardia. That's why you see kids with these kind of problems are tachycardic. Heart beats faster because it's trying to compensate. The right side of the heart ends up with extra blood that it doesn't really need. And so it has to work harder to try to pump it through to the lungs. So the right side of the heart is doing a lot of extra work, and you end up with a right ventricular hypertrophy. Hypertrophy just really means a stretched out, worn out muscle. Okay? And so the right side gets tired, and so it doesn't work as efficiently. And now the lungs are getting too much blood, so you're going to end up with a patient who has an increased pulmonary vascular resistance. And this is going to make him sound congested. He's going to cough a lot. He's going to have shortness of breath, trouble breathing, tiring easily. Okay, does this all make sense? And this is what happens with this particular kind of problem. What could they ask you? These are the kind of questions that they've often asked about at this particular kind of defects. Sometimes with the atrial septal defect, because of the location of it, it's actually up near the AV node, and it sometimes can cause an arrhythmia besides if there's AV node involvement. Also, the ASD, or the atrial septal defect, is sometimes a remnant of the foramen ovale that doesn't close. A persistent foramen ovale. Remember the foramen ovale we talked briefly yesterday? This is a persistent foramen ovale. It does not close after birth, and it leaves this alternate pathway for the blood to flow. With the ventricular septal defect, and this is actually the most common of the acyanotic ones, this ventricular. The only thing that they probably ask you about, this tends to have a loud, harsh murmur. I don't personally believe that you, as entry-level nurses, really need to distinguish different types of murmurs. That's why cardiologists make so much money, because that's their job. But on the boards, sometimes they run out of questions to ask you, so they ask you things that probably are not appropriate for you to even know. So in case they do that, you know that this has the loud, harsh murmur. Forget about all the other murmurs. This is the one, only one that they've been known to ask about. And why is it loud and harsh? Because of physically where you... It's located in the ventricle, which is closer and easier to hear. That's all they're going to ask you. How do they fix this? They close it by a suture or a patch, and they won't ask you about that. The patent ductus arteriosus, they probably won't ask you anything about that either, but I usually include the four most significant defects. I will tell you the two that they will ask you about. The patent ductus arteriosus also is a persistent fetal vessel. The ductus arteriosus actually connects the aorta to the pulmonary artery. Can you all see it on the handout? The aorta is connected to the pulmonary artery. And with the aorta connected to the pulmonary artery, what happens is blood flows from the left side of the heart with oxygen, right, up into the aorta without a problem. It goes up around the arch, and as it passes the ductus arteriosus, some of the blood, instead of going to the systemic circulation, it drops back down into the pulmonary artery and goes back to the lungs again. So you end up here with, once again, decreased cardiac output. Okay, not enough is going to systemic circulation. Does all the blood have oxygen on it? Yes. All the blood has oxygen, just the volume isn't enough. And now there's going to be too much blood going back to the lungs again. So you're going to end up with increased pulmonary flow, just like you do in the other ones. And you're basically going to have very similar problems. What are they going to ask you? Probably not too much. How do they treat this? Interestingly enough, if this is detected in the neonatal period, particularly with premature babies, because they tend to have a big problem with this, because their body's not really ready to get rid of this ductus arteriosus anyway. They can give a drug called indomethacin, and indomethacin, actually, one of the side effects of indomethacin is it's a prostaglandin inhibitor. And they seem to feel that when prostaglandin, which is a hormone that is in the baby's body at birth, when the prostaglandin levels in the baby's body start to drop, it stimulates this ductus arteriosus to close. So prostaglandin drops, this closes. Indomethacin makes prostaglandin drop, stimulates the ductus arteriosus to close. That's how the drug works. It only works in the neonatal period. This, if you give it to an older child, there's no prostaglandins, so this is not going to work. Only works in the newborn nursery or the NICU. If the child is older and still has a patent ductus arteriosus, he will go and have a procedure called the Rashkind umbrella technique. Basically, they go in during cardiac catheterization, and they literally get into that vessel, and they open a little umbrella. And that's the end of the rain of blood coming down from the aorta into the pulmonary artery. And that's how they do it. Did you talk about, you talked about cardiac catheterizations in med-surg? Same thing. Kids and adults, it's basically you do the same thing. So any, if they ever ask you a child question about cardiac catheterization in regards to children, answer it the same way you would answer an adult, okay, as far as the procedure goes. The most common cardiac defects that, oh, well, not the most common, but the most commonly asked questions on the boards. In the acyanotic group, it's the coarctation of the aorta, the next one. Coarctation of the aorta is the most commonly asked question. It's not necessarily the most common defect, but it's the one they're going to ask you about of the acyanotics. What happens with coarctation? First of all, you already know it involves the aorta because the word aorta is in the title. Coarctation is another word for stenosis. So basically what it is it's a stenosis of the aorta. And if you look at the picture, you can see the aorta comes out from the left ventricle and it goes up and arches around. And at the descending portion where it starts to begin to go down towards the systemic circulation, there is a stenosis or a coarctation there, a pinching off. So what happens is blood comes out of the left ventricle with oxygen, right? There's nothing to indicate there's an oxygen problem, right? Blood comes out of the left ventricle full of oxygen, goes up into the aorta, and as it reaches the arch, it meets a path of resistance. It comes against a roadblock. So what does it do when it meets a roadblock? It looks for the path of least resistance. Like if you get stuck in a traffic jam and it's a really bad one, you're going to get off that highway and you're going to look for an alternate route, right? Well, that's what the blood is going to do. Can you see any alternate routes? I see a couple of alternate routes it could go. There are three vessels pointing in a whole other direction. Okay? Those are the three vessels that go to the upper extremities and the head. It's the brachiocephalic artery, the subclavian artery, and the one of the carotid arteries. They're not going to ask you which the names of the arteries are. Don't worry about it. They probably don't even know themselves. Just know that the blood is going up. So now you're going to have an increase of blood flow to the upper part of the body, the arms, the head. You're going to have a decreased blood flow to the lower part of the body, the legs, the feet. So what do you think that's going to do for pulses? You think you'll have equal pulses? No. You're going to have bounding pulses in the upper part, radial pulses bounding, pedal pulse. What do you think you're going to find pedal pulses? Weak and thready. Weak pulses in the lower extremities, bounding pulses in the upper extremities. Because you have extra flow to the head, you're going to find that the child is going to experience headaches, epistaxis, which is nose bleeding, and increased intracranial pressure because there's so much flow going up here. This is the patient with the hypertension of the upper extremities. This is the question they usually ask. This child has a discrepancy of blood pressure findings. When you take 4-point blood pressure on any normal, healthy person, do you have higher pressure in the legs or in the arms? Legs. You always have higher pressure in the legs because it takes more pressure to return blood back to the heart from the legs than from the arms. Now we're going to find that this child has higher pressure in the upper extremities in comparison to the lower. The lower extremities are not getting enough flow to begin with, so they're going to have low pressure. So now you have a discrepancy in blood pressure where you have higher pressure in the upper extremities, lower pressure in the lower extremities. That's probably what they either ask about the nosebleeds. They usually ask about the nosebleeds or the blood pressure discrepancies or the bounding pulse. These kids also will experience leg cramping because of the lower pressure to the legs, lower flow. There's not enough flow to the legs. So these children also complain of leg cramps. They never ask about the treatment. They only ask about the signs and symptoms. But I'll tell you the treatment anyway. Basically, they go in and they try, with a balloon angioplasty, they try to stretch the stenosed portion of the aorta. If the balloon angioplasty does not work, and they do that during cardiac catheterization, just like they do balloon angioplasty for arteriosclerosis and all of those other diseases, they will go in surgically and they will remove the stenosed portion and they re-astomose the aorta back together. Children who have histories of coarctation of the aorta are more likely, or we can say at higher risk, to have other abnormalities of the aorta, such as aortic aneurysm. Because if one part of your aorta didn't form correctly, there's a good chance another part of your aorta also did not form correctly. So this is a person who's at risk for aortic abnormalities or aortic aneurysms. But so far we're still talking about kids. Are these kids going to look cyanotic? Not likely, unless they're very stressed. We don't want to stress out any kid who's got decreased cardiac output. So these are the kind of kids in general. You don't want to make them cry excessively. When you go in to do something, you want to do everything pretty much all at once because you don't want to keep coming in and disturbing these children. They need to rest. Do you need to really set limits to their activity? Not really, because children are much smarter than adults when it comes to these things. Remember what I said earlier about children who don't feel good? Children who don't feel good don't jump around the room. So children who have cardiac problems, who are having difficulty maintaining their endurance, they are not going to push and force themselves to do activities that they're not capable of. So you don't need to really set limits for them. You really, really don't. You need to support optimal growth and development. The real focus, long-term focus, is supporting optimal growth and development. The child, if he's tired, he'll stop the game. That's why children don't have heart attacks. And adults do. You ever wonder about that? You ever heard of a child having a heart attack? A stroke? Well, strokes, yes, but for different reasons. Okay, so that's your acyanotic portion. We're going to just talk about one cyanotic defect because they will not ask anything else. They love this topic. This is the favorite question of pediatrics. They always throw one question in on this particular defect. This defect is one of the cyanotic types. It's not the only cyanotic type, but it's the only one they'll ask you about. This defect is called tetralogy of Fallot. It's on page 9. Tetralogy means the study of four. Tetra in Latin means four. Fallot is a French guy who decided he was going to name this defect after himself. Maybe he didn't have any children, I don't know. Anyway, when you have tetralogy of Fallot, right away you know that the word four is pretty significant. It means you have four components of a defect. What are the four components? Well, you have a ventricular septal defect. That's one of the four problems. You also have a pulmonic stenosis. You see the pulmonic valve coming out from the right ventricle? Now that goes to the pulmonary artery. You see how small the pulmonary valve is? Okay, so that's going to be a problem with getting blood flow out of the right ventricle. You also have what we call an overriding or juxtaposition aorta. The aorta is not coming directly out of the left ventricle. It is coming out somewhere in the middle between the left and the right ventricle. It's closer to the right ventricle than it should be. Those are the three big problems. The fourth aspect of this problem is really a result of the other three. You end up with a right ventricular hypertrophy, which you'll see why in a second. So here are the hemodynamics. Blood comes in from the lungs to the left atrium. It then pumps down to the left ventricle, and some of it, and it will start to pump towards the aorta with oxygen. So far, we don't have too big of a problem. On the left side of the heart, blood comes in from the right atrium with no oxygen, right? Because it's being returned from the systemic circulation. It pumps into the right ventricle, no oxygen, okay? And it's going to try to get into the pulmonary valve to go back to the lungs and get oxygenated. But the pulmonary valve is very small, and it doesn't let the right amount of blood in. So the pressure is building up in this right ventricle. It's starting to fill up with a lot of blood, and it's got to send it somewhere. So with each beat, Some blood will get into the right, some blood will get into the pulmonary artery, but a large amount of the blood is going to shunt from the right side towards the left through the VSD without oxygen, and it's going to end up in that aorta that's very close to that opening anyway. Now you see how you get acyanotic blood. Now you see how you get a cyanotic condition with unoxygenated blood into the systemic circulation. Okay. Normally the left side of the heart is stronger and has more pressure, but because of the pulmonary stenosis, the right side is working much harder than it usually does, and it's exerting greater force than the left side. So it's pushing the blood from the right to the left, and this is also known as a right to left shunt. Okay. Normally, normal shunts always go left to right because the left side is stronger. Normal shunts. But this is an abnormal shunt. No shunt is really normal, but this is really abnormal. So now you're getting unoxygenated blood being dumped into the aorta from this hemodynamic situation. And now you've got a kid who's got circulating hypoxia. Is this intermittent or chronic? Chronic. Anybody who has chronic hypoxia is going to be chronically cyanotic. So this kid is going to look a little purplish. Blue, whatever color you want to call it. Nobody really ever looks blue. They usually look purple. This kid is going to have a very low oxygen saturation and a very low PO2, chronically. This kid is going to have clubbing of the fingers and toes, because anybody who's chronically hypoxic starts to develop clubbing of the fingers and toes. What other kind of patients develop clubbing of the fingers and toes? COPDers, right? Because aren't they chronically hypoxic? Okay. And this kid is chronically hypoxic because of the hemodynamics of his heart. If I give him 100% oxygen, am I going to improve his oxygen status, his circulating oxygen? No, because no matter how much oxygen I put in his lungs, when it comes into his heart, what's going to happen? You're still going to get oxygenated blood. So giving this patient oxygen does not help them. This is not a patient who oxygen is going to do anything for. Because the first thing you feel like you want to do is give him oxygen. Let's just put a nasal cannula on him. He'll be all better. Doesn't do anything. These children also have what are called TET spells. A TET spell really is just a hypoxic episode where if they're really under stress and they're not meeting their oxygen demands, they will start to have an altered mental status. They'll be very irritable. Basically, that's a TET spell. It really just means a hypoxic episode. But they like to call it a TET spell. Okay, so don't let them throw you off. It just means the kid is very hypoxic. These kids don't grow. They have failure to thrive, which that's what the FTT stands for in your handout. They have failure to thrive. They don't grow well. They can't eat well. They tire very easily after feeding. And one of the other things that happens when somebody's another thing that happens in chronic hypoxia, when somebody's chronically hypoxic, the body doesn't know why they're chronically hypoxic. So one of the things the body does to try to compensate, it says, well, maybe the problem is we don't have enough red blood cells. Maybe if I had more red blood cells, I'd be able to carry more oxygen. So the body starts to actually create unnecessary red blood cells. And these kids end up with what we call polycythemia. They have too many red blood cells. They actually have an elevated HNH. Their blood is too concentrated. Because the body says, well, I'll just give you more red blood cells and more hemoglobin, and then maybe I'll get more oxygen. But it doesn't work like that. Because no matter how much red blood cells, you're still getting this shunting of unoxygenated blood being dumped into the systemic circulation. So they end up with this polycythemic circumstance, which polycythemia predisposes you to clotting. So these kids also sometimes throw clots, and they can actually end up with embolisms from clotting. One of the things that the child will do in order to compensate for this condition, they do something called squatting. When they squat, they literally bend down if they're old enough to walk. When they squat, it actually helps with venous return and it helps them oxygenate better. So nobody teaches them this. It's a compensatory mechanism. They just start to do it. So if they're asking you about positioning for this patient, if they say what would be the most comfortable position, putting this patient in a knee-chest position actually serves them better than elevating the head of the bed. Because elevating the head of the bed, it's not an oxygen issue. Okay, what the problem is blood flow. Okay, this is a blood flow issue. So we want to improve blood flow. Putting them in a knee-chest position is the closest thing to putting them in a squatting position. Okay? So if they said, what would you do for the child who's having a TET spell? Give oxygen, elevate the head of the bed, put them in a knee-chest position, or, you know, throw ice on them. You put them in a knee-chest. Don't laugh about throwing ice. We do throw ice on patients with certain cardiac problems. Anybody know what problem that is? SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, particularly in children. If you shock them with ice, it causes them to cardiovert back to a normal rhythm. So you're going to put this, because everybody wants to give these kids oxygen. You see oxygen, it makes you feel better. Oh, we'll give oxygen. Okay, but forget about oxygen. Put this kid in a knee-chest position. That's the answer. Okay. They sometimes ask about the TET spells and the squatting. That's the two most, that's the most asked question on this particular problem. Sometimes they ask about the name of the procedure. What they do something called the Blaylock-Taussig procedure. Interestingly, the Blaylock-Taussig procedure, which is in the handout, what they do is they create a ductus arteriosus. The Blaylock-Taussig is actually, they make a ductus arteriosus, and then what it does is it allows some of the deoxygenated blood that got into the aorta to shunt back to the lungs, and it helps increase flow to the lungs. That's a temporary repair. Then they go and they repair the pulmonic valve, they close the VSD, and they move the aorta over, and everything, if the child isn't too, you know, severely ill or the heart's not too damaged, the child will do okay. Okay, but this usually requires several steps in the procedure. It's not a one-shot deal. This child usually goes for several surgeries before they're finished. Just quickly look at the cardiac drugs, and then we'll go to lunch. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I know you talked a lot about cardiac drugs with MedSurg, but babies get digoxin. The level, the therapeutic level for digoxin is the same as it is for the adult, and I have it there for you to review it. The difference is with digoxin and the baby, when you, with an adult, when do you hold digoxin? Right, with a pulse below 60. When do you hold digoxin for a baby? Below 100, okay? Toxicity, we already mentioned a little bit earlier today. Usually it's GI. Early toxicity is GI. Late toxicity has to do with the effect of the drug on the body system. Generally speaking, as a general rule, toxicity of drugs, early toxicity of drugs usually upsets your GI tract. Late toxicity of drugs usually upsets the body system that the drug was intended for. So if you're getting confused when you're looking early, late, think of it that way. Lasix, you all know about Lasix. What do you have to worry about with Lasix? Potassium. Okay. Diuril, they probably won't ask you about Diuril. Basically, it works in similar ways to Lasix, and you have to worry about potassium. And just answer it however you would answer a Lasix question if you don't know what to do. Okay? Okay, here's a pediatric question. A mother brings her child into the clinic with multiple bruises noticed on the child's body. The nurse's responsibility is to report to the head nurse, to report to the Child Abuse Bureau, take a detailed history from the child's mother, document all findings. Okay, so let's look at this. The nurse's responsibility is, mother brings a child with multiple bruises. Okay, what do you really need to do here? Okay, what we really need to do is get a detailed history. We need to find out what exactly happened, and then you have to make a decision. Okay, multiple bruises by themselves do not necessarily indicate child abuse. Multiple bruises. A kid could have fallen off the swings and, you know, hit a tree and fell and rolled over and hit a rock and could have sustained multiple bruises. So just multiple bruises by itself, that's not actually one of the cardinal signs of child abuse. But we need to be concerned. So we need to get a better story. We need to see, how did the child acquire the multiple bruises? Okay, reporting it to the head nurse. First of all, you don't have to do that anyway. Even if you were going to make a report of child abuse, you don't need to report that to anybody. We usually discuss it, but legally, you may report without telling a head nurse, without telling a hospital administrator. Your hospital might have a policy on that, but legally, you do not have to report it to anybody but the child abuse. But in this case, we're not going to report this right away because this really is not one of the red flags of child abuse. Multiple bruises is not a red flag. Okay, bruises in various stages of healing would have been more suspicious. Okay, there was an OB question here, which I didn't go into detail about this. The answer was to get a more detailed history. You want to know what happened before you're going to make any decision about what you're going to do. Okay, here's an OB question. Which of the following patients is more prone to postpartum hemorrhage? The multip, whose labor took 8 hours. The primip, whose labor lasted 6 hours. The multip, who has 2 false labor pains and who was also given an infusion of Pitocin and the labor was 8 hours. Or a primip who delivered twins in a normal delivery that lasted 6 hours. Okay. Who's more likely to have bleeding issues? Who's more likely? First of all, what's the number one cause of postpartum hemorrhage? What? Okay. Well, retained placenta is one of them. And what's the other? But what's the real problem? The problem is that the uterus is not contracting, is not able to contract, right? Okay, so in which case here would the uterus have the most trouble contracting back to its normal size? A multip, a primip, a multip who had Pitocin, or a primip whose uterus was stretched more than the normal amount of stretching with twins? Okay. If you stretch a rubber band further than another rubber band, which rubber band is going to take longer to snap back to its regular position? The one that's stretched more. So the primip with twins is more likely to have issues with hemorrhaging because her uterus was stretched further and it's going to take longer for that uterus to involute back to its normal size. Okay? And so that's the answer. I mean, he didn't send us the answers because he doesn't know what they are, but I'm telling you that's the answer. That question comes up a lot. That's definitely the answer. Pick the uterus that got the most stretched out. Okay? Multiple gestations have a higher risk for hemorrhaging than most other kinds of patients unless there's other uterine abnormalities. But all things being equal, the one that stretches the furthest is the one that's going to have the most trouble recoiling. We're going to talk one more. We're going to discuss one more of the cardiac problems. This is one of the acquired ones. I will briefly talk about it in case they ask you. If you go to page 10, you'll see a picture of a young boy who has rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is a systemic inflammatory disease, and it causes inflammation of connective tissue. We don't know exactly what causes it, but we think it's caused by group A beta hemolytic strep infection. The same strep that causes strep throat, right? If strep throat goes untreated, the strep bacteria gets into the bloodstream and it lays dormant there until it goes into another body system and causes problems. So, if you're suspecting rheumatic fever, one of the important questions you would ask the parent, has your child had a sore throat recently? Okay, because strep throat usually causes sore throat. And if the mother says yes, that's a reason to be somewhat concerned. When we're looking at rheumatic fever and we're deciding whether or not a patient really has it, we look at a lot of the signs and symptoms, and that's how the diagnosis is made. Excuse me. The diagnosis is divided into two categories, the major symptoms and the minor symptoms. You must have two of the major symptoms or two of the minor symptoms plus one of the majors in order to actually be diagnosed with rheumatic fever. You either have, okay, I'll repeat it. Two major symptoms have to be present, or you have to have two minor symptoms plus one of the major ones. Excuse me. If you have three minor symptoms, you do not have rheumatic fever. If you have one of each, you do not have rheumatic fever. Okay, you have to have either two of the majors or two of the minors plus one major. What are the majors? What are the minors? Okay. Since this is an inflammatory disease, anything that's inflammatory basically is going to be major. So any of the symptoms that end in itis are pretty major because they're inflammatory. So if you look at the list, carditis, that's inflammation of the heart, that's an inflammation, major. There's something called erythema marginatum, which is a rash that occurs on the abdomen. Is it considered one of the majors? These children develop what they call subcutaneous nodules, like lumps under the skin. And you can imagine lumps are sort of inflammatory, so that's major. They oftentimes develop something called chorea, which is neurological, a neurological effect, which causes jerky movements. And basically anything that affects your neurological system is pretty major, right? That's a major situation. And what we call polyarthritis, okay? It's itis. Polyarthritis means inflammation of the joints, multiple joints. And it's major because it's one of the itises. So those are the majors. On the minor list, you have things that are very vague and ambiguous. Having had a previous history of rheumatic fever, a prolonged PR interval on EKG, a fever, an elevated sedimentation rate, some other blood work, and joint pain, arthralgias, joint pain. Those are all minor. So you can see the difference. The major ones sound pretty important. The minor ones are vague and could be really attributed to many different causes. Okay, that's probably all they'll want you to know. The other important thing to know about rheumatic fever, the goal of the care for the patient with rheumatic fever really has to do with maintaining cardiac function, because a lot of times these kids end up with permanent cardiac damage. So rest, no stress, decrease the amount of stimulation, decrease the amount of stress, and basically the other thing that's important with this, these patients go home on prophylactic antibiotic therapy. So teaching involves the parent understanding that the child must take antibiotics for an extended period of time. So if the parent says, okay, don't worry, I'll give Johnny antibiotics until he's feeling better, okay, you know that they didn't understand the instructions. You must, what would you do? Further teaching. Okay, so if they give you a scenario where they say the mother, you've just taught the mother about the antibiotic therapy involved with rheumatic fever, and the mother responds by saying, okay, fine, I'll give Johnny his antibiotics until he seems to feel better. What would the nurse's next action be? Document the findings, reteach the patient, okay? So you would reteach the patient because that's an indication they didn't understand you. Okay, that's the way they're going to word things. They're going to tell you what happened. You have to interpret the findings. And that's all they're going to ask you about rheumatic fever. So you can look it over a couple of times. I wouldn't go sweating over it too much. Okay, the chances of you getting a rheumatic fever question are not the greatest. Maybe, but not definitely. I can guarantee you'll definitely get a cardiac, pediatric cardiac, like a tetralogy of Fallot or coarctation question. But this is a maybe. So look it over. Just remember certain things about it, but don't sweat it too much. Here I gave you a fairly good explanation of dehydration, but they don't ask you specific questions on it. So what I'm going to do is just going to sum it up quickly, and you'll read it over at your leisure. But what I want you to know about dehydration, first of all, just out of a point of interest, it's the number one cause of death in children in the world. They're not going to ask you that. But it's the number one cause of death for children, not in this country, but in the world at large. More children die of dehydration than any other cause. All right. So it really is a very important, significant, serious problem. But the boards are not going to ask you specific questions. But you do need to understand the concepts, because dehydration applies to many other physical conditions that you might be dealing with. Okay? And the first on the list of things that affect well-being as far as physiological, is airway, right? And next after airway, we worry about fluid. Okay, so it's really an important thing to know. All right, so the four causes of dehydration: vomiting, diarrhea, poor intake, or increased metabolic rate. Okay, those are four things that can cause you to become dehydrated. If they ask you any questions about dehydration, basically what you need to be concerned about is how severely dehydrated the person is and how are you going to restore them back to adequate hydration, because that's the important thing. Get them back to a level of adequate hydration. Basically, in an overview, when somebody's mildly dehydrated, they usually have a 5% body weight shift or loss. But the other thing is, if you're looking at somebody who's 5% dehydrated, what happens is the body compensates. When you get a little dehydrated, your body will compensate for that decreased amount of fluid that you have. What does it do? It stops getting rid of excess fluid. So, decrease urine output, decrease tears, and decrease saliva. Basically, when you're mildly dehydrated, all the wet stuff from your body dries up. Okay? It's being conserved. As you get progressively more dehydrated, obviously you're going to lose more body weight. The body will now start to try to compensate by speeding up some of the systems. So, for example, you're going to get tachycardic because the body's going to try to compensate for the lack of fluid volume. So you'll find some tachycardia, increased thirst. Okay, the body's going to turn on mechanisms. The body's going to turn on mechanisms to try to try to replace and restore some of its fluid, and as well, it's going to try to compensate for the loss that's going on. If it continues to get worse, basically what's going to happen is the child is going to lose about 10% of its body weight or greater, and the child is actually going to start to dry up on the inside. So what happens is the eyes look like they're sunken. The skin turgor, they start to get poor skin. Poor skin turgor is a late sign. Skin turgor should always be evaluated on the abdomen of a child, not on their hand like you do with adults. So children have, you know, their skin is new and fresh. It usually has good elasticity. So you're not going to see poor skin turgor in children until they're really, really, really dry like prunes. Okay? And so as you get more severely dehydrated, that's when you're going to find that the child is going to have poor skin turgor. The inside is drying up, basically. And that's kind of a good way of thinking of dehydration, early to late. Basically, what you want to try to do is rehydrate the patient under interventions. You're going to offer what are called oral rehydration solutions. Okay, that's what ORS stands for, oral rehydration solutions. Oral rehydration solutions are made from electrolyte balanced solutions. Some of the products on the market are Pedialyte, Lytrain, Rice Light. Anything that's got the word light in it is probably one of those electrolyte balanced solutions. The old-fashioned way was to take some sugar and salt, right? Some of your mothers or your grandmothers probably made solutions for you out of sugar and salt. More or less the same thing, only not so scientifically measured. And then basically what we need to do is really measure the INO. We want to make sure that what goes in is equal to what comes out. And that's really, really all you need to know. You just need to make sure that the patient does not end up with fluid and electrolyte imbalances, and if they do, they need to be restored either orally or parenterally through the IV. If the child has bad diarrhea, the other thing you have to remember is skin care, because anybody who's got bad diarrhea is going to have skin breakdown. Does everybody know what the BRAT diet is? You see it listed there? Banana, rice, applesauce, and toast or tea. The BRAT diet is considered advancing the diet from the dehydrated patient back to a regular diet, especially if they've had a lot of GI upset. So if they talk to you on the boards about a BRAT diet, it doesn't mean it's just given to bad kids. Okay? It stands for banana, rice, applesauce, and toast or tea. Basically, it's a diet that doesn't cause too much GI irritation. Most of the time, what I find is a child's been vomiting for 3 days, he lost a little bit of weight due to body fluid, really, more than anything else. And the first thing that the mother wants to feed him is chicken, potatoes, you know, French fries, like very heavy foods. But the child's stomach usually can't handle that. And sometimes if you irritate the GI, you're going to get the kid vomiting all over again. So you want to give them this very mild brat diet. And that should do it. And that's all you need to really know. They won't ask you too many specific questions about this, so don't sweat it. Just know it in general. We're going to talk about some of the GI dysfunctions now. First of all, I'm going to mention briefly, I talked about it very slightly this morning, failure to thrive. Failure to thrive can be caused by organic reasons or non-organic reasons. Organic causes of failure to thrive are when the child has an underlying physiological thing. Like a child with a cardiac problem who can't eat because he's too tired, he's not going to grow. He's not going to gain enough weight. He's going to have organic failure to thrive. His cardiac problem is really causing him not to be able to eat enough to gain weight. So he's got an organic reason to not grow. Whereas a child who hasn't been well cared for by its primary caregiver, but there's nothing physically wrong with him, he also may not eat well or grow well. But that is a non-organic failure to thrive. Usually, we consider children having failure to thrive if they are below the fifth percentile in the weight curve. Okay, the weight curve is based on general norms. There are some children who are a little bit off the curve depending on their ethnic background. They come from, you know, parts of the world where people are just a little bit smaller or bigger. But generally speaking, any child who's below the fifth percentile, who you do not know has an ethnic reason for being below the fifth percentile, would more likely be considered a child who's not growing properly and has failure to thrive. A lot of these kids with the organic, the non-organic type, or even the organic type, they also don't develop properly. They don't sit up when they're supposed to. They don't walk when they're supposed to. I have a friend who just adopted a baby. She's 1 year old. She's been in an orphanage for a year, and she doesn't sit up yet. There's nothing physically wrong with her. I mean, she's physically healthy. She has no physical problems. But probably because she wasn't stimulated, and who knows what her experiences were with primary caregivers, she has not, and she's also she's very much below the fifth percentile. And this is a baby who has no physical reason for being delayed or small, other than her experiences have caused her to be small and delayed. She's been catching up very nicely in the few weeks that they've had her, but this is a child who probably has non-organic failure to thrive. It can be cured, but you have to be able to identify it. So that's basically what you need to know. I don't think they're going to ask you anything else. I think you really just need to know the difference between the two and what causes it. And basically what you have to do to fix it is to really provide the child with emotional support, particularly during feeding time, and to really be evaluating the child on a daily basis. Is the child gaining weight? Is the child achieving developmental milestones? You need to keep reevaluating the child. And I don't think they're going to ask you anything else about failure to thrive. I'd be very surprised. They're more likely to ask you about a cleft lip and palate. They like cleft lip and palate. Cleft lip and palate is very popular on the boards. And what happens with cleft lip and palate is the child is born with a congenital anomaly involving the cleft, involving the upper lip, and the hard or soft palate. In the book here, you have a couple of pictures. You have a soft palate, cleft. You have a unilateral complete and a bilateral complete. The difference between the two, let's separate them for a second. Sometimes the child will have one, or sometimes the child has both. The child who's born with the cleft lip, the problem has to do with, more than anything else, its body image. Mother sees the baby and the baby does not look cute. That's very, 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 very important to a parent that their baby look normal, okay, and look good and look cute or look nice, okay? Otherwise, Baby Gap wouldn't be making so much money. If people weren't into making their babies look a certain way, all of these fancy baby stores would be out of business. But people go and buy cute little things for babies. You think babies really care what they're wearing? No. Who wants to see them in those fancy little clothes? Their parents do. So when you get a child who has a physical deformity, especially right on the face, that's very detrimental to A, bonding, okay, and psychologically for the parent in dealing with the child. So the biggest problem for the lip isn't physiological for the child. It's psychosocial, the bonding. So how do you help the parent deal with this? One of the best ways you can help a parent deal with a child who has a physical defect like that is to role model for them. Show them that you accept the baby. If you hold the baby and nurture the baby in front of them, it's showing them that you have accepted the baby. Okay, that's one of the things that you can do. Role model good parenting skills in front of them. Because there's nothing worse than a parent who sees that their child is unappealing and then that's confirmed by the staff. So if you can show them that the child is appealing to you, very oftentimes they will overcome some of their fears of bonding with this child. Don't say, oh, don't worry, we can fix this, or, oh, it could have been worse. Don't say any of those things. Don't even say, would you like to hold your baby? The other little trick to answering board questions, never ask a patient a question that they have to answer yes or no to. If they say, what would you say to the patient? And one of the choices says something and the patient would have to answer yes or no, it's definitely wrong. Okay? Never give them a choice. Never say to a patient a question where the patient has to answer yes or no. Well, you know, you have to use your judgment, but basically, with things like this, any psychosocial things, you want the patients to have open-ended opportunities to answer things. How do you feel about your baby's condition? Now, that would be more appropriate, but do you want to hold the baby? Bad question. You're putting them on the spot. If they say no, that makes them a bad parent. If they say yes, they don't really want to hold the baby, and now they're saying yes to something they don't really want to do. So you're going to role model by holding the baby and showing that you approve of the baby. Okay, sometimes you can also do that by saying, oh, look at how nice and curly his hair is. A distraction. Emphasizing something positive about the baby. It will detract what's negative about the baby. I do some home care now. I have a little baby that we take care of. He has a syndrome where he actually has a cleft palate in the soft palate. And he also has a receded chin. So he has an internal defect and an external defect. And part of helping his mother bond with him is that we really talk about lots of other features about him that are very positive. Like he has very nice hair and he has very pretty eyes. And, you know, we talk a lot about that. We don't really sit there and discuss, well, let's see, how small is his chin and how funny does it look and do you think it's ever going to get better? And, you know, the emphasis is on the positive things about the baby, not so much the negative things. And that mother is bonding very, very nicely. Okay, with the palate, the big problem is creating suction. So the baby's going to have problems sucking and swallowing. So the main problem with the palate is going to be nutrition. This is going to be a child who's going to have trouble getting adequate nutrition because he may not be able to suck and swallow adequate amounts of formula. He also may aspirate. As he's trying to suck and swallow with this big hole in his palate, lots of times the milk comes back out of his nose and then they aspirate. So these are the things you have to worry about with this child. What you can do to alleviate some of the potential for aspiration and to help the child get more nutrition, hold the child in an upright position during feeding. The more upright the child is, gravity will also help bring the milk down from the mouth to the stomach. We also use special nipples and bottles. We use what's called a lamb's nipple, like a lamb, like you would feed a lamb with, a big long nipple. It goes further past the defect, and the child can then put some pressure on it, and he's able to pull the milk out. And that's what you're going to do prior to the surgery. Okay, what about the surgery? Well, the lip is usually repaired by the time the child's about 2 months old. The lip, we do first. Even if the child has both defects, the lip is always done first. When the child comes back from having the lip done, he's usually in a side-lying position. We want to avoid having anything rubbing against his face because his lip is on the outside. You don't want the suture line to be irritated. We want to keep the sutures clean. And we usually put this child in what they call elbow restraints. Elbow restraints literally keep the child from being able to bend his arm. Okay, so he won't be able to touch his face and scratch his lip. Can you take off elbow restraints?
Yes.
Should you be taking them off? Yes. Because if you keep them on too long, you can actually even cause contractures for people or children who've had restraints on for too long. You want the restraints off, and you want the child to exercise and have range of motion with supervision. We also put something over the face called a Logan's bow. What it does is it literally holds the cheeks a little bit closer together to each other, and it takes the pressure off the lip line. It doesn't allow the child to stretch his lip when he's crying, and it prevents the suture line from being pulled with pressure. And it's on the list there. It's a Logan's bow. Okay, and that's basically all you need to know about the lip baby. The baby with the palate. The palate is usually repaired around the second birthday. Usually not much sooner than that. Reason? We want to allow the jaw and the palate to grow. Otherwise, it'll interfere with tooth eruption. But we also don't want to wait too long because we don't want it to interfere with speech. And usually most children are really developing their speech patterns at around age 2. So we want to try to fix this before the child is really speaking. And so age 2 is about the perfect age. When the child goes for surgery for this, when he comes back, immediately in the post-op period, okay, in the recovery room, when they say immediate post-op, they're talking about in the recovery room. Okay, you're going to put this child in a prone position. Another word for prone position is dorsal recumbent. Okay, for vocabulary, dorsal recumbent and prone are the same position. You're on your stomach with your head to the side. This allows for any drainage in the mouth to come out more easily. You're more likely going to drain it in that position. If you have the child laying on his back, all of the secretions are going to run back down his throat, and he might choke on them. So we want him in a prone or dorsal recumbent, head to the side. It'll allow for drainage. He's also going to be in elbow restraints, and there's a picture of them actually on the page. And we also want to be careful after surgery not to put anything inside this child's mouth. No bottle, no straw, no spoon. We want this child drinking everything from a cup for the first several days after surgery, because anything you stick in the mouth could damage the sutures. No toothbrush. You have to be very, very careful. The child should only be drinking and using a cup. Now we're talking about a 2-year-old. Some 2-year-olds don't really drink well from cups, mostly because it hasn't been introduced to them. So if you were caring for a child who has a cleft palate, you would tell the parent to introduce the cup when? 3 days before surgery? 6 months before surgery, a week before surgery, or the day of surgery? 6 months before surgery. Because you want a kid who's really good at drinking out of a cup. You don't want a kid who just learned and now he's in a stressful situation. You think he's going to want to drink out of a new cup? No, he's going to ask for his bottle, right? You want a kid who really has been drinking out of a cup for a significant period of time. So we need to make sure that the parent knows to introduce the cup months before the surgery. And that's what you'll need to know about the cleft palate. I don't think they'll ask too many other questions. I basically covered all bases on the cleft lip and cleft palate. The next one on the list, they do ask sometimes one question. This is a one question topic. It's called pyloric stenosis. In pyloric stenosis, what happens is the baby is born, and several weeks after birth, he develops hypertrophy and hyperplasia of the pyloric sphincter. Where is the pyloric sphincter located? The pyloric sphincter is located between the stomach and the duodenum. So what's the other sphincter called? The one between the esophagus and the stomach? Cardiac sphincter. So what happens here is the sphincter between the stomach and the duodenum is very narrow. It's overgrown. It gets thick. And so it doesn't allow milk to pass down into the intestines. So the baby drinks milk, the milk gets in his stomach, and then it has trouble going any further. And so what does it do? After a while, it takes the path of least resistance, and it comes back up. And so this is where we get this progressive projectile vomiting. This is the patient with progressive projectile vomiting. Just remember, pyloric begins with P, and progressive projectile vomiting also begin with P. It's all the P words that begin with vomiting, that have to do with vomiting. So he drank milk, he vomits it back up very forcefully, projectile. Everybody knows what projectile means, with force, right? And what does this vomit look like? Does it have bile? Does it have blood? Is it frothy? No, what does it look like? Milk. Because the child swallows milk and he throws up milk immediately after finishing drinking. So the vomit is usually milk. Sometimes they ask you what the vomit looks like. That's all they usually ask. Sometimes they do occasionally have mentioned the olive-shaped mass. If you palpate the abdomen of a baby who has this, you will actually feel a little knot in their belly, because you can actually feel this little hypertrophied area. Where would you feel this? If you were going to feel the abdomen of a child who has suspected pyloric stenosis, where would you assess for this mass? That's right, the right upper quadrant, because that's where the pyloric valve is. Think about it. Here's your stomach on the left side, and here's your intestine starting on the right side in the upper quadrant. So it's the right upper quadrant is about where you would feel this mass. And so they're going to ask you. They will not ask you anything else. They never ask you about the surgery. But just so you know, child usually has this repaired, goes home a day or two later, never comes back again. It's completely resolved. What's the age range for this? The age range for this is about 6 weeks. Because the baby's probably born with it, but it gets progressively worse as time goes on. So by 6 weeks, these kids are usually vomiting all the time. So it's usually 6 weeks that they have surgery, and it's more common in boys than girls, if they ever ask you. If they ever ask you and you're not sure, most things are more common in boys than girls. Most defects. If you don't know for sure, pick boys. Boys are born with more defects. The next one they'll probably never ask you about, but I'm going to mention it briefly so you know what to answer in case it ever comes up. You have something called esophageal atresia with a tracheoesophageal fistula. Basically what happens here, either way, you're going to have problems with swallowing. In some of the cases with the esophagus ends in a blind pouch. And sometimes with the tracheoesophageal fistula, you have a problem because the esophagus and the trachea are connected. So it doesn't really matter which one you have. Don't worry about it because the symptoms are going to be the same. What happens is when these children swallow anything, it either doesn't go anywhere, it sits in this blind pouch and it comes bubbling back up, or it drips into their lungs straight from their esophagus into their trachea. So either way, this child is going to be choking and gagging and having trouble swallowing. These are the children who have difficulty swallowing, they drool, they cough, they gag, they have trouble breathing. Even though this is a GI defect, the biggest problem for these patients is airway. The number one problem here is their airway, because they cannot manage their airway. They're drowning. Basically, they're drowning in secretions because they can't swallow them. So the most important aspect of care, the priority here, is clearing the airway. How do you clear the airway here? Suctioning, right. How often do you suction this patient? Q4 hours? Intermittent? As necessary. How often do you think as necessary would be? Intermittent, continuous? This is pretty much continuous suction. Don't you produce saliva continuously? Okay, think about it for a minute. If you couldn't swallow any of your saliva, how long do you think it would take till it would fill up and make you feel like you were choking? So these patients go on continuous low wall suction. Okay, continuous low suction. You want to be removing all the saliva as it's coming in. They should be sitting with the head of bed elevated to prevent aspiration. You know, even though it's a newborn baby, we usually elevate their head. Okay, so the big problem is A, airway. Our next problem after airway is fluids, because the child is not able to take in any fluid. And the third problem after that is nutrition. Okay, usually when you have somebody who's really sick like this, it always goes in that order. Airway, fluid, nutrition. Okay, because that's what sustains life. And that's all they're going to ask you about esophageal atresia. Don't learn anything else about it. Usually it can be fixed, not always. Don't worry about it. They won't ask you. Just hope you never see a kid with it, because it's really a very, it's a big problem. The next one on the GI list is intussusception. They do ask about this. Here you have a picture of it in the handout. Intussusception is also known as invagination or telescoping of the bowel. Basically, what happens is the bowel slips inside of itself, and it causes obstruction. It's most common in the infancy period. Very rarely see this in older children. Basically, what happens is, this is a mechanical bowel obstruction. So, first off, what happens is the child starts to have pain. But this is an infant, so he's not going to tell you he has pain. So how would you know if an infant has abdominal pain? Yeah, he's going to be drawing his legs up crying and getting stiff and drawing his legs up and crying. Okay, that's what paroxysmal abdominal pain means. He's crying off and on because his belly is hurting. They sometimes start to vomit like anybody with a bowel obstruction would. And if you palpate the abdomen, you will feel a sausage-shaped mass, which is the obstruction. You can actually feel it. Here's the question that they always ask. Many times the child will have an unusual-looking stool, and it's called a currant jelly stool or a red jelly stool. It's a reddish kind of stool. Basically, what you're seeing is blood and mucus in the stool. The child has a stool full of blood and mucus, and that's a late sign. This is actually a late sign of this problem. Once you've got bleeding and mucus in the stool, this has been going on for a long time, because what happens is it causes bowel compression. And when you have bowel compression, you're not getting oxygenation to tissue, and then you get necrosis, and then the bowel tissue dies, and then you get the bleeding and the mucus. So it's really a late sign. But anyway, that's what they're going to ask you about the currant jelly stool. That's the classic question on intussusception. The other classic question on intussusception, in order to diagnose it, they do a procedure that's not only diagnostic but also curative. They ask you that too sometimes. In the real world, they use air. They do this with air now. But in the boards, they'll probably still ask about barium. They use the medium barium as an enema, and they actually inject it into the bowel, and it shows up on x-ray, and at the same time, the force of the barium actually forces the bowel to stretch out, and it pops it back to its normal position most of the time, not always. So if they ask you which of the following procedures is both diagnostic and curative, you're going to pick barium enema, okay? If barium enema is not one of your choices, but there's something about injection of air into the bowel, pick that one, okay? Because you can inject air and it'll work the same way. But barium, if the barium's on the boards, pick that as your first choice. If barium is not one of your choices, inject air, okay? They give it like a boost of air. Can intussusception reoccur? Yes. So you need to teach the parents signs and symptoms of intussusception, because it does come back. And that's all they're going to ask you about intussusception. I guarantee you they wouldn't ask you anything else. Hirschsprung's disease has another name. A lot of these things have two names. Hirschsprung's disease is also known as megacolon. What happens here, this is interesting. I'm trying to think what they'd ask you. Oh, here's the question they'd probably ask you. Okay, what happens in intussusception is, in portions of the bowel, the child is missing what we call ganglion cells. Ganglion cells are part of the parasympathetic nervous system, and what they do is they initiate peristalsis. If you don't have ganglion cells in your bowel, you're not going to have any peristalsis. So if you look at the picture, you see the portion of the bowel. There's a portion of the bowel where it says there are no ganglion cells present. So the portion of the bowel adjacent to that has become all stretched out and dilated, because as the waste product is going through the bowel, it hits a roadblock. It can't go any further because there's no ganglion cells to push it through. So what happens is a portion of the bowel actually becomes distended and all stretched out and fills up with old necrotic stool. So sometimes what happens is that portion of the bowel is full of stool. The stool has nowhere to go. It starts to break down. It literally starts to literally just leaks out. It literally just leaks through. It doesn't really get pushed through. It leaks through kind of a watery, thin substance. And this child will have thin pencil or ribbon-like stools, very foul-smelling, and abdominal distension, because he's not really moving his bowels. It's just that the excess is just running out. One of the other interesting things, if they ask you, what is the earliest sign that a child would have intussusception? The earliest sign of this is meconium ileus. These children have difficulty passing meconium. Remember yesterday I said there are certain conditions in pediatrics where kids don't pass meconium? This is one of them. That's all they're going to ask you. They hardly ever ask about Hirschsprung's. They don't like it. Oh, they might ask you, what they do to fix this, it's surgically. What they do is they have to surgically remove the damaged part of the bowel, and then they have to give the rest of the bowel a resting period, so they create a temporary colostomy. So these children usually have a temporary colostomy for maybe 6 months or a year until everything is repaired and fixed, and then they close the colostomy. So the child will have a temporary colostomy. And you may have to do colostomy teaching. And if the parent, here's the other thing that they would ask you. Of all of the developmental milestones, which milestone would be delayed in this patient? Potty training, right. Bowel training is going to be delayed in this patient because it takes 2 or 3 years to fix everything. Usually at least 2. Most of these kids are finally having their final surgery and their colostomy closure at around 2, 2.5 years old. So that's around the same time as sphincter control. So these kids often have delayed bowel training. And that's the other question that they would ask you. They will not ask you anything else. PKU is one of the things that we test for when we do newborn screening tests. PKU is an inborn error of metabolism. It's auto-recessive, which means it's inherited. The only thing you need to know about PKU, here's what they're going to ask you. Children who are missing this enzyme, children who have PKU, phenylketonuria, they are missing an enzyme that converts phenylalanine to tyrosine, and they end up with a buildup of phenylalanine in the blood. Tyrosine is a protein. Okay, so the issue here, the big problem here is with protein. That's the big problem. These kids who have this usually have a musty, funny odor to their skin, and they often have very fair skin and a lot of eczema. And if they do not get treatment, or if they are not on a special diet, it will affect neurologically, and they will end up with brain damage and seizures. But if the child is put on a special diet from birth, they usually don't have any problems, and they grow up fine, normal, and healthy. The trick to knowing this is PKU screening is a blood test, and you have to know when to do it. The PKU screening cannot be done until the child has ingested something with protein. So let's say the baby is born, and he goes to the newborn nursery. You can't send the blood for PKU until he's been fed either formula or breast milk. If you've only given him glucose water, you will get a false negative result on this test. So the child has to have ingested protein before this test is valid, because this is a test that shows there's an inability to break down protein. If the child is diagnosed with PKU, he then goes on a low phenylalanine diet, which means low protein. Okay, if they ask you, if they give you a diet tray for the kid with PKU, pick the lowest protein, no protein. Keep away from protein for these kids. Can they have carbohydrates? Yes. Can they have fat? Yes. They can't have protein. The diet should be maintained for at least 6 years. Why 6 years? Because which body system does this problem affect? Neurological, right? And how long does it take for the neurological body system to completely mature? 6 years. Once the neurological system is completely mature, it's not as problematic. So as long as the diet's maintained for at least 6 years, the child usually does okay. That's what they're going to ask you. I don't think they're going to ask anything else. This is done by blood test. Thousands of years ago, they used to do it with a urine test. Not really thousands of years ago, but maybe 20 years ago, they used to do this by urine. So sometimes the boards, you know, they forget that we're in the new millennium, and they ask you old questions. So there used to be an old test called the Guthrie test. The Guthrie test was a urine test that they did to determine PKU. But in the real world, that test is in a time capsule somewhere. Hernias and hydrocele. The most common type of hernia is the inguinal hernia, and it's more common in boys than girls because it's an incomplete closure of the processus vaginalis. The processus vaginalis is actually where the testicles were before they were descended. So sometimes there's still an opening there, and intestines can drop down through that. Basically, you don't have to worry about a hernia unless it's irreducible, unless you cannot push it back in. And what they do is they usually just surgically repair it. And because it's in the inguinal area, it's in the groin area, the child usually is wearing a diaper, and so you really have to be concerned about infection. So the thing to teach the parents is frequent diaper changing after the surgery. And I don't think they're even going to ask about it. The umbilical hernia, they're probably never going to ask you about. It's an incomplete closure of the umbilical ring, and it's a protrusion around the umbilicus. It's very easily reducible. It almost always resolves by itself. Usually they don't do surgery on this until a kid is still has it at age 5. Most of the time it goes away by itself. Diaphragmatic hernias, they're not going to ask you. The only thing you should know about a diaphragmatic hernia, what happens is there's a hole in the diaphragm, and all the abdominal contents shift into the pleural cavity. And sometimes what they do is they displace the heart. And so you can have a mediastinal shift. You've heard that term before, right? Mediastinal shift makes the heart shift from the left to the right. And so the child with this, although his heart's probably not going to be beating for very long anyway, but if you're listening for heart sounds, and you may not hear them unless you go more towards the right. And this is the child who's born with a scaphoid abdomen. Remember yesterday I said newborns have a round contour to their abdomen? This baby has a sunken or scaphoid abdomen because all his internal abdominal contents are in his chest. Many times these kids, their lungs are permanently damaged. This prognosis for diaphragmatic hernia is not good. Their lungs usually don't develop properly because they're compressed all through development. And so these children usually don't survive. Sometimes they do, but it's usually not a great prognosis. Okay, we're still in the GI area, but now we're not talking so much about defects. We're going to look at metabolic disorders like celiac disease. Celiac disease, and there's just a few questions on celiac disease, not too many. Celiac disease is an inability to tolerate foods that contain gluten. Gluten is found in all wheat products. Nobody knows exactly whether it's an inborn error of metabolism or an abnormal response. Basically, you end up with a malabsorption syndrome. Whatever the cause is, the child cannot absorb anything with gluten, and then it sets the GI tract off into not absorbing anything at all, and the child starts to have very severe chronic diarrhea. The hardest thing for them to digest once their bowel's been really irritated by this gluten. The hardest thing to absorb is fat, right, in general. So they're more likely to have difficulty absorbing fat. So they usually will not absorb fat well, and they end up with fat in their stool, which is called steatorrhea. And fat in your stool is any kind of a stool that's frothy, floating, foul-smelling. That all means that there's fat in the stool. Fat in the stool is going to float. It's going to be frothy, foul-smelling. That's all fat. And because they're not digesting well, they're not absorbing well, they get muscle wasting. They're just not really healthy kids.
Please move to the next section of the lecture series.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.